what they had in Trail was a fairly strong kind of cadre of communist members. And they were, for the most part, local communists. They weren't beholden necessarily to a party leadership in Vancouver or Toronto, where there were main leadership pockets. They knew their marks to a large extent. That was something that, I mean, they were talking about four or five people at the start, right, who actually led the drive. And Slim was the guy at the head of it, Slim Evans. But they came to it as local communists. They came to it as people who had the ideology down, but knew that that wouldn't fly locally particularly. Also, they knew they were being confronted with all sorts of, as I said earlier, anti-communist views. So they were finding ways to be trade unionists, to use their ideological underpinnings to actually try to get a union in there for starters, which was a 6-year struggle, and then to hold it together when a lot of other enemies came along to try and undo it. So they couldn't really be ideological in the sense that they would promote communist policies directly, but they did, and you know from the Mine Mill Constitution, they did have good principled stands on many things. Now, you know, on race, on gender, and on even the environment. It's Local 480, by the way, the Mine Mill Local and Trail. Local 480 took some good stands on that, but you know, we'll come to the chapter on women workers and on, you know, women generally. They weren't too good stance. They were breadwinner people. They believed that a male breadwinner social system was workable and they wanted to stick with it. So, you know, where you might have had communist policy that suggested otherwise, not all of it, but some of it, that was kind of being taken to task by the local union, not particularly feminist oriented.
See if I can kind of summarize from reading the book. Basically, you treat them as good, strong, militant unionists. That's what the leadership consisted in, focusing heavily on bread and butter issues with, as you've just said, some interesting policy kinds of positions. Our listeners, of course, know about McCarthyism in the US and some of the consequences even for unions in the US that were led by Communist Party members or affiliates. How'd that play out in Canada?
Well, the book does talk about Canadian McCarthyism. It seems like an oddball thing to call it, but in fact, it came across the border in its various ways. And the government of the day, the Laurier government, actually embraced some of the McCarthy policies to try and get rid of the Reds. And the Reds under every bed kind of policy, and they were determined to go after the trade union movement in that respect, both with the federal and provincial governments, but also with other institutions within society at that time. So you get this this kind of odd kind of McCarthyism, and it's being picked up at the border, because we're 10 miles from the border in Trail. So they're getting a lot of feedback from Spokane, which is the largest nearby center. And this is all kind of percolating. You're getting a lot of the activities that are being, the union activities that are, you know, sort of wobbly-like or, you know, kind of violent activities are being talked about in the local press and condemned in the local press. This is how they're portraying unionism, right? So communists get basically called violent, and basically they're leading the revolution, they think, but they're leading right down a path which is going to get them in a lot of trouble and locally. These guys were the ones I'm talking about in the book were stalwart lefties. They knew what they were doing. They knew what they had to do, and they were gutsy. They were willing to take some chances. Guys like Jack Scott, you'll read about, who was a strong left winger, a veteran of the World War, a decorated veteran of World War II, came into Trail, and he was not a guy who was a wallflower. He wasn't going to sit back. He knew he was a communist. When later became a Trotskyist, and he basically said, "We're going to do something in this town to make sure it's a worker-friendly town as much as possible." So that's a little bit of the answer. I'm hesitant to move further into the 50s when you've got McCarthyism really hitting pretty hard. But there are some interesting cross-border issues there. The book talks about two of them. One was the removal of Paul, a famous opera singer, Paul Robeson's passport, when he went to sing in Vancouver at a Mind Milk convention and was told by the Secretary of State in the US that he couldn't do that, that he was banned from traveling. The Mind Mill Union basically went to bat for him. And that resulted in four pretty memorable border conferences. They're called the Peace Arch Concerts. And sorry, concerts, not conferences. And Robeson sang for 4 years in the early 50s each year as his way of connecting with the Canadian workforce and Mind Mill members in British Columbia. Again, there's a half a chapter on that, so people might find that interesting as an American connection. And, you know, Paul was an incredible supporter of Mind Mill. The other event that was really fascinating for me was the showing of the film Salt of the Earth in Trail, in that area, back in 54, because that was basically... How to summarize this, Norm? I mean, basically, this was a Hollywood 10 movie. The people who were ostracized from Hollywood for being communists made a film about a strike in the early 50s in a little town in New Mexico. And this one of the incredible parts of the strike, from my point of view, was that they tackled a big zinc corporation and they won. They said, "This is not on the way you're treating us here." And one of the really mainstays of it was that the women of the town basically took on the role of pickets, and they picketed the company, and they kept the picket line alive and protected the picket line all during the strike. And that was a big part of the film, Salt of the Earth, was just showing how that developed and showing the role of women and the consequent role of men having to do the diapers and get the laundry out and do some of the homework because they were banned from the picket line. So just an incredible story of a community that rose up and said, the company's not going to beat us. I think it was inspiration for the Trail people and for the people who supported Local 480 to see this film. And this local union had the guts to show it. It was a banned film, and they brought it into Canada and brought it into this little area of British Columbia and showed it to the people there and got a full house five times. So it was pretty neat.
We're talking about some of the implications of having Communist Party leadership, militant leadership in the Mind Mill Union. There are a lot of associated questions that I want to come back to, actually. But earlier you talked about the response to that to communist leadership in the press, by the company, within the church. A big area we haven't addressed yet is other unions and the response being a raid by another union, actually my old union, the steelworkers.
And mine.
Yeah, and yours. And it was yours because, well, by the time you were working in the smelter, the steelworkers had basically taken over. But Mind Mill was able to resist until they ended up merging with the steelworkers. So talk a little bit about that process. What does the raid look like? And let's actually hold off on the question of how Mind Mill resisted. I want to come back to that and talk about it more directly, because sure, they were successful in resisting in some important respects.
Yes.
So what does a raid look like?
Well, in this case, as you say, the steelworkers were more or less sanctioned by the CIO to take over Mind Mill locals. Now, these guys are already organized into a union. It's a member union of an affiliate of the CIO. But at that point, because the union movement, as it's represented by the CIO, decided that communists were bad and needed to be taken out, Steele was given the mandate to do that. They went ahead with passion. It's a big union at the time. There are a million people, members of that union, and it's got a huge bankroll. So it can go into a town like Trail with, you know, maybe 12,000 people at the time, 5,000 workers, and it can start to work its way in and say, you don't need this Mind Mill local union anymore. You need us. So I'm trying to sort of skirt around what actually happened, but essentially they set up a system of radio advertisements. There was a local radio station there, by the way, CJAT. They bought press time. They published big full page ads. So it became a kind of war of words between the mine mill people and the steel worker people. And there were both, because at this point, the old company union had actually been banned. The law in British Columbia had banned company unions, but it didn't ban independent Canadian unions. And this was kind of the early days of the Canadian nationalist fight for unions to be Canadian, not just international, as the American unions were called. So this kind of was the battleground. The battle zone was steel coming in and basically making a lot of noise, and the mine mill guys fighting back. And again, it was a war of ads, a war of radio speeches, a war of meetings and big conferences to just basically try to give the respective sides of the arguments. And the mine mill side was usually to try and say that whether we have communist leaders or not is not the issue. Are we doing a good job? Are we negotiating good agreements? You know, are we taking the stands that we should take as a workforce and trail against the company when the company does the wrong thing? So that, to me, was the beginnings of the beginnings of the raid, because what happened was that the local got taken over by a guy who once worked for a mine mill, who then decided he was an anti-communist, and he ran for president of Local 480 and won in 1947, the very year that they passed the infamous Taft-Hartley Act in the States. So again, which had some crossover effects on Canada. He basically then led a movement to remove mine mill from trail and from the smelter workforce. That's when the steel workers stepped in.